AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to this very special episode of the Empire Podcast in association with Disney Plus. But this one isn't just an Empire podcast, folks. This is another one of our fabled co-pros with our beloved sister podcast, the Pilot TV Podcast. Hello, James Dyer.
Hello, Chris Hewitt.
Hello, hello, hello. And this one is dedicated to FX's epic new samurai saga, Shogun, which is streaming now exclusively on Disney Plus. And joining me to talk about it is the aforementioned James Dyer. Hello, James Dyer, once
Konnichiwa.
Again. And we're also saying konnichiwa, hello to Nick Dissemblian. Hello, Nick.
Konbanwa.
What does that mean?
Which means good evening. So it's very appropriate for...
Not really for 12:44.
Yeah.
It is 12:45. We're in the afternoon, so that's totally fine.
We're heading into the evening.
Nick and I, as I'm sure we will get to at some point, have been to Japan. We've been to Japan together. We went on holiday to Japan a long time ago now, Nick.
We were young and full of hope.
Young and full of hope, and simply one of the greatest places on earth, one of the best holidays you could ever hope to have. But I was not fluent in Japanese at the beginning, or indeed by the end of that.
I have big holiday envy. Actually, I'd love to go to Japan. I have to be said, this series, although it is filmed entirely in Canada rather than actually in Japan, like it really desperately made me want to go to Japan. It looks wonderful.
It is. It's amazing. We'll get to that. We will get to that. But first, this is about Shogun, the 10-part limited series, which is on Disney Plus. And before we get into the show and talk around the show and talk about all things pertaining to the show, let's hear from a couple of people involved with the show, shall we? First of all, you're going to hear from the showrunners, the married couple in real life, who are also the co-creators and showrunners on Shogun, the Shogun runners, if you will, Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo. James spoke to them recently. How was it, James?
It was great. It was great. I enjoyed it immensely. I got to nerd out with them over this.
Excellent stuff. So here we go. Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks and James Dyer. Enjoy.
One of the things about this that really struck me is, so I'm a massive nerd, love speculative fiction, science fiction, fantasy, very much my jam. And watching this, even though it's a historical drama, it feels to me as much a fantasy in some ways as something like Game of Thrones, because you have this incredibly strange, let's be honest, realized world with these curious customs. And then you're sort of seeing it through the eyes of this stranger going in there. And it does feel kind of magical. And I wondered whether that was at any point something that crossed your minds when you were putting it together.
Rachel's probably dying, because as husband and wife, she's like, this is just the question that Justin's been waiting for. For 5 years.
I'll pay you after this episode for not asking this very question.
You know, thank you. I think that speaking only for myself in this case, I come to genre probably from the same place that you do, from how it sounds, which is I love science fiction, the world building principles of science fiction. I think, by and large, you know, when you look at some of the most interesting period drama, they're very often constructed in the way that good science fiction is constructed. Honestly, like the best example I can think of, which here's a thing that was really in our bloodstream when we were writing Shogun and sort of rewriting it over the pandemic, was watching The Remains of the Day, mm-hmm. which actually feel like is one of the best science fiction movies never made, and you know, a book in that sense too, because of the way it sort of understood that if you're going to bring an audience to a world, you really need to build it from the ground up and understand by and large that audiences are coming to it from maybe outside, whether it's outside of culture in the way that we came to this story and sort of you know, being aware of our gaze in the window that we're looking at or through. But also, even if one is Japanese, you know, looking at it from a place of it's 1600 Japan, I mean, there's a different sort of value set. And so rather than, you know, we had to learn all of these details. I mean, Callum Puente, a writer producer on this show, had to build an instruction manual that was 840 pages long.
Almost as long as the book itself.
to do it in very close detail. And so, you know, we wanted as much as possible to show our work, so to speak, you know, if you're doing the math problem analogy here. And so that yields something, I think, that works by the world building principles of what science fiction is.
How did that work? Like using that manual, how did you sort of like incorporate that into what you did? Because as I say, I think it's an important thing. And a lot of fantasy authors will do that. They'll create their sort of world building Bible before they start with their narrative, because the world is as important a character as any of their protagonists, right? Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what we called it, our Bible. And the interesting thing was that the Bible was the manifestation of the evolution of the process in which we had to learn how to tell the story, right? And so as we learned how to marshal all these details, all this stuff that was new to us, we had to learn and build the mechanism with which we use to tell the story.
Yeah, it's a good, because it's like someone asked recently, well, can you share some of that? And there are pages that we shared, you know, with just various groups or people who wanted to see it. But so many of the pages, as I like flip through the stereo instructions of this show, are actually just like very like inside baseball, like, you know, what Callan will write on is like, you know, that the way we shot it in week one, you know, these were the mistakes we made here and here, and this is what we learned and how we do it differently and all those things. It's like that was really, you know, it was this learning document, it was this growing document with Frederick Crins, one of our historical advisors, a professor at the University of Kyoto, you know, sending artwork paintings from the period with circles of hairstyle. It's like more like this actually is more of a Chinese hairstyle and something to avoid, and this, you know, and all these kind of just like very close annotations that are probably exhausting to anyone, you know, outside of it. But the crew, you know, really did just kind of rely on these annotations as we went through it.
Now, I haven't read the book, not just because it's like, what, 1,100 pages long. I mean, it's a very, very famous book, but I've not read it myself. And I'm not sure how the author gets you into this world. But I thought this was done very well in the series, that one of the first things we see is obviously we see Toranaga at that sort of council meeting, and one of his sort of vassals speaks up, and there's the seppuku sequence. Now, he doesn't just kill himself, he ends his entire line. And it's so extreme and so shocking and so alien that I think more than anything else, it feels like a statement of intent, that this is so far removed from our experience of society and life. And I wonder, was that lifted from that section of the book? Did you bring that up? Did you introduce it? How did that come into it?
It's a great question. We pulled that forward from a later portion of the book as a means of really introducing Toranaga and, you know, at the kind of start of his plight. But it also, and the seppuku in the story really evolved. Our understanding of seppuku evolved as a writer's room, as you know, it was a predominantly Asian American, Japanese American, female writer's room that we had on this show. But to understand seppuku is a real journey from outside of that culture. And we worked with consulting producer Mako Kamatsuna, you know, kind of for months trying to get closer to what does this scene mean?
Yeah, you can't just read about the concept and understand it. You have to kind of live with it and think about it when you're not thinking about it, you know? And I also think that we brought up that scene too in order to introduce the character of Mariko. I mean, that the scene that follows with her essentially supporting her friend and having to sacrifice her small baby. I mean, yikes. I mean, that's like you said, it's tough. And I love how you put it, though. It's like our world, but several degrees removed, and what is that like? You know?
And so the key challenge for us, because that scene that Rachel's describing, that follow-up scene that came after the council scene, was an invented scene on the show. It was something that that Rachel wrote to introduce Mariko and to introduce the value system. And what we were really after with that was, you know, it was very, there were many bad drafts that we would put together of that scene, I would say, you know, when it came to what we're reaching for. And we realized over and over again that we were exoticizing this behavior pattern, you know, from the outside, because like anyone who doesn't come from this culture, I think we were really fascinated by it and says, well, this is very different from us. So we want to just show it for all of its differences. What we're very proud of in the end with that scene, you know, when you look at Anna Sawai, Moeka Hoshi, who plays Fuji, their performances in that is, and Jonathan Van Tulleken, who directed it, I feel like it's a really, in the end, it became just something fundamentally human. And it wasn't, I hope, an attempt to just like, you know, fetishize this behavior that would be willing to do something that we can't from a modern day perspective understand, but actually to kind of get to a human truth about it, which is that no one wants to do that. No one wants to do that. But there was a war going on and there was a cause and there was a purpose and there is a these people, these women in this case, are reaching for meaning and agency in their situation. And this is for the least powerful of a group, this is maybe one way to exert some control over the path of their own destiny. And that became the kernel of understanding for us of the entire show thematically, you know, of how to kind of build it was the journey towards understanding that.
I love that scene with Mariko. In fact, if I'm honest with you, Mariko is by far and away my favorite character in this entire show. I think it's just, she is so complex and her struggle is so real and so integral to the plot. And actually, on a purely thematic level, she's more important than Blackthorn by far. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's in many ways an observer and she is a part of this. You know, she's up to her neck in it. And she's so, I mean, Anna Sawai is wonderful in the role, but it's just, it's so interesting that we see so much of that character. Whereas, and it, bearing in mind, I was extremely young when the Richard Chamberlain series landed on television, but I have a very dim recollection of her being sort of more of a love interest type character in that story. Whereas in here, it's integral. And this story is a three-hander, right? Like, this is not a white savior story. It's three characters giving three very distinct perspectives. When you sort of set out to do this, was it always like, right, this is not Blackthorn's story. We're telling this story. This is a Japanese story first and foremost. And, you know, he's there.
We always went to the book, truthfully. And the book very much, I'm not too sure about the series, but the book very much has this as the three-hander. This is a very thick braid of three parts that are constantly moving and swirling and looking to each other for what's next. And so we didn't go into it thinking one story was going to be, you know, we always knew that obviously this is Shogun. This is Torinaga's, the we're under his umbrella, of course. But very much so a three-hander. So
yeah, I also think that, you know, Mariko sort of stole a lot of the narratives or from our hearts, you know, as the story developed, because she is so crucial to it and her journey is so modern in some respects, that it gave us that permission to do so. I think insofar as the story involves Blackthorn, you know, and then you mentioned the sort of the white savior narrative, you know, that was definitely one of those tropes that we were hoping, you know, we're always in search as writers of new cliches, right? And not old ones. And that was something that felt like, I mean, there's a representational aspect that is obviously problematic that we wanted to avoid. But I think the greater sin was just, it was a story. I've seen that story so many times before and just so bored by it. I wouldn't show up as an audience member. And it's because Shogun was such an impactful work that over the years, so many stories that derived from it in period as well as science fiction, you know, I think have sort of taken that and what new things are there to say in that world, you know, because of the legacy of James Covell. But you look at the book and the book is already doing more with it, you know, and it's wonderful without, you know, getting into sort of very specific spoilers. I'd say by and large, the journey of that character in the book, as well as in our show, is a journey of a character who realizes ultimately all of this probably would have happened whether he was there or not. And the sort of the arc is a spiritual one to accepting what you can't control and accepting your place in that. And I think that's a very beautiful modern journey that was set forward in 1975 by James Clavell. So we were really intrigued by that component of the book.
Yeah, I love that aspect that he's anything but a white savior. He's just a white guy who's there, right? Like, because he doesn't actually bring a great deal. It's not like The Last Samurai where he learns the Bushido code and somehow he's John Wick. I mean, he can't even, he's at one point, he literally says, I'm a sailor. I can't use a sword.
You know, I can't resist when you bring that up, though, telling one of the stories, which was really one of our favorite moments in the writer's room, because one slight change from the book was, I think, it's in the business of episode four, when Blackthorne is kind of introducing weapons to his Japanese allies. You know, it's a sort of famous part of the book. And I think that we really honed in on that as like, what do we do here? Because it feels in the book, it was actually muskets that he was kind of introducing. Now, you look historically and muskets were introduced, you know, through the Portuguese a good 50, 60 years earlier than the time of this story. And so historically, we were kind of up against a reality that said this is not that we can't play into this trope that we've probably seen before. And it was our historian who presented the idea. But, you know, cannon, the Portuguese weren't as good with cannon as the English or Dutch. And so that would be something new if you wanted to do that. And so we decided to actually bring that process into the show where you have Blackthorne trying to sort of talk about tactics of muskets. And like, no, we know all this, dude. Like, we get it. We've been here. Give me something new. And so Blackthorne actually has to go through that process of like a grifter who's trying to think of a new con and be like, cannons, let's talk about, you know, and play that. And so it's where the history actually gave us new cliches, right? And to kind of lean into that fun. But sometimes, you know, you have to make those little adjustments for a modern audience.
Yeah. It's nice. I mean, you mentioned the modern audience. I always found it interesting that obviously the 80s show wasn't subtitled, but, and it wasn't Japanese, but you had Orson Welles doing this incredibly surreal narration through, which was just nuts. But what I love about this is, I mean, this is roughly 90%, I would say, in Japanese, isn't it? Pretty much, I would say. And it feels so I'm one of these awful people where I often find subtitles a barrier because they pull me out. They make me aware that I'm watching something and I'm not in something. And I did not have this here at all. And I wondered whether it was, I don't know quite whether it's just Japanese is just a very, you know, emotive, powerful language, but, or it was the setting, but I think it was the tone. This didn't feel like an outsider's perspective of the story. It felt like you were being sort of embraced and welcomed into the sort of Japanese culture. And maybe it was the mindset of it, but I love that. And like I said, I've not read the book. The book, I guess, is an outsider's perspective on Japan. And I wondered, what were you hoping for from viewers in this? Because it feels like, as you're watching this, certainly by the time you're in episode sort of three, you feel like your perspective is a very Japanese perspective. You start to see the Westerners as barbarians, as I think, you know, the Anjin does as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now I'm getting suspicious because somebody, this is a question that I would pay somebody to ask.
You know, I do think that, and it's like, how many days do you have to talk about subtitle theory for us? You know, we really, because honestly, like my biggest pet peeve is someone who, you know, grows up on foreign film and, you know, just devours these movies. And of course, the lens that you do it through is going to be through subtitles, right? But my pet peeve about it is that we have always looked at subtitles as an afterthought as a culture, in my opinion, in terms of how we engage with the story. And then when we do that, of course, it's going to feel as if they're a nuisance to the process because you want to engage with the performance. You want to engage with the story. And so we really began to look at like navel gaze, what can we do to change that? And one of the things that we really did, and this, I mean, you know, John Landgraf was part of this conversation early on about how do we do this? Because we want it to be subtitled. We want to, you know, let these characters speak in their own language, these actors perform in their own language. And so, you know, we said, well, we have to be aware that the mechanism, 50% of the experience of some of those scenes, it's going to be the experience of, in some way, reading them. And so one of the things, the easiest thing, you know, I can point to is to say, we have to color time the subtitles to be constantly aware of what background they're in front of so that you're never fighting with where you are. And that means that our colorists would look at every frame and every word and sort of see that. The other was that we would bring those subtitles higher into the frame than anyone had done before by localization, so that what I call the dive, where your eyes are going down to the bottom of the screen, was minimized. Which
I noticed because I found them much easier to read than I normally do with subtitles.
I don't know why we don't do this more. I think it's because we let our cinematographers decide where the words should be too much, but our cinematographers framed knowing that there were going to be words at the bottom, because we were doing this in our own culture, and not shooting this in Japan. So we knew that the lens was going to be through that. And then lastly, and this is the couples therapy component of it. We went through a very detailed translation process for this show. It was written in English, translated by a team in Tokyo into Japanese, then polished by Kyoko Moriaki, a Japanese playwright, to make sure that the language was converted into a Jidaigeki Japanese, that then Hiro Sanada, our producer star, as well as Eriko Miyagawa, another producer on the project, would comb through that to sort of make sure there's a little modernity in the Japanese, and this sort of works quickly. And we don't speak this language, so we had to really take their word for it as collaborators. And then the actors would perform it and add their flair. And then what we would do through a Japanese assistant editor, we would, instead of going off the script, we would translate those words back from exactly what was said. And then Rachel and I, in the process of post, would look at our script and look at what actually came through in the telephone game, and then decide, how do we marry them for intention? And where do we do line breaks across the subtitles? What word should hit when her eyes blink there? Because I hope, my deepest hope with this show is, if you watch this the way it's intended with the subtitles on screen, you're going to get a better experience than you've ever gotten before, because you're seeing words and performance married closely. That we're saying, like, it shouldn't be an exclamation point there. It should be a period there, because he's not yelling. He's actually just sort of speaking that, and it shouldn't feel false, manufactured, and the page we took from that, when you speak to genre, was, I look at some of the best subtitles I think anyone's ever done. You look at the subtitles for Star Wars movies, I think they do it really well. We kind of, took a font that reminded us of a Star Wars font to achieve that. And, it's my hope that sign up for this show and you're going to get something that hopefully maybe we change the way, it certainly changed the way I'll do subtitles in the future,
No, but now we're getting to the second part of your question is, what do we hope viewers receive from all of this? And truly, we're just hoping that they can sense viscerally that the care and the consideration that was put into every moment of this show. And I'm hoping that viewers will bring the same level of care in an openness to it, right? And to receive this. And because it's different, it it asks a lot of you as a viewer, but boy, did it ask a lot of us as people who tried to help bring it into the world. So,
and then hopefully it gives back.
Yeah.
Because of, and this gets back to your thing about your question about the book. There was such interiority in the book. Clavel was inside of these characters' heads, and to deny them a voice, to deny them a language, to hold them at arm's length just because it's a culture whose language we don't speak, felt like, why would we tell that story today? You're completely denying yourself as storytellers all the layers of this wonderful book. So the words were a means of getting closer to the secret heart of the characters themselves, and then it could be much richer an experience than we got to see before.
Wonderful. Well, that's absolutely fascinating, and the thought of that, this makes a lot of sense to me now, having watched those subtitles and seeing how they were put together. I'm going to watch it all again just to really take that in. It was incredible. But guys, thank you so much for your time. It's very much appreciated.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, that was Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo talking about Shogun. And now let's hear from one of the show's stars, Cosmo Jarvis, who plays John Blackthorn, who is an English sailor, a pilot, an engine, if you will, who is in many ways the audience's eyes and ears into the world of 16th century feudal Japan. And James also spoke to Cosmo Jarvis. Here we go. Cosmo Jarvis, enjoy.
Hello, James. I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad at all. Honestly, that's a very nice outfit you've got on, by the way.
Thank you for saying that.
No problem at all. So I guess watching it, like the first thing that kind of struck me was the sense of scale to this. Like it is massive. Like it feels like this huge production, you know, anything on a scale with really anything that you could name. And I was just wondering how prepared you were for that. Like how did it, what you read on the script relate to what you saw when you set foot on that set?
Well, I mean, I suppose when I first read it, I knew that it was going to require a lot of resources to manifest, but it wasn't until actually witnessing the resources that I got a sense of everything had been sort of meticulously crafted and thought about and built and designed, in rigs were made for special effects and villages were built for sets and greens were dressed and presumably brought in from elsewhere. I mean, and the stunt teams and what they had done and how the horse, the animal wranglers of every kind. I have only really done sort of smaller, I guess, indie type films where the scope of the story or the environment that the story takes place in is relatively smaller. And this was the first time that I had to consider how to adapt how I'd worked previously into something that was so vast and had such broad strokes of narrative.
How much, if anything, did you know about 17th century Japan? Like, are you a history buff? Did you have all this stuff in your head beforehand?
I am now. I only had a sort of a very superficial understanding of anything Japanese, really. Just the residual things that are present in, I guess, UK pop culture and American pop culture that are sort of left over from Japanese or the things, but not certainly nothing from, I had no understanding of the complexity of the country and the sort of power struggles that were going on, which Japan was caught in the middle of. And I didn't even know about the Catholics and the Protestants, really. I didn't know about anything. So I had a lot to sort of familiarize myself with.
Yeah, it's wild, isn't it? Because you've got there's an inherent xenophobia, isn't there, in that period of Japan where they didn't really allow outsiders in. But then you've also got the fact that the Portuguese are there. So you've got this other kind of weird foreign influence in there. And so when the Anjin gets there, you know, he's got these sort of Japanese overseers looking over him, but he's also got essentially his sworn enemies, the Portuguese, who he really doesn't seem to get on with at all, right?
No. And I mean, I guess understandably too, there were, I didn't know that the Vatican sanctioned the awarding of land to the distribution of land between them, just simply because it fell within a certain parameter. I didn't know that. And I guess, yeah, it's one thing being faced with your sworn enemy, but then being faced with your sworn enemy when you're also a prisoner of another potential enemy is quite a difficult thing to navigate.
I mean, it's a totally unique sort of like period in history. So my sort of first encounter with Shogun was obviously the 80s show with Richard Chamberlain, so a long, long time ago. It still kind of sticks in my head though, because it was one of the first TV events that everyone was watching. It was an absolute sort of like fixture in everyone's lives. But I remember the one thing that sort of stuck out for me is that it's obviously Toshiro Mifune who played Toranaga in the original series. There was a thing where Richard Chamberlain said, when Mifune had his armor on, like when he had his Toranaga face on, no one would dare talk to him. Like no one would go up to him. He'd just sort of growl at them. He's always in character. He never left that kind of Toranaga mindset, because Toranaga has that imposing, aloof quality, you know? And I thought that Hiroyuki Sanada kind of really, really tapped into that. But presumably he was slightly more approachable in between takes.
Yes. It's interesting to hear that, because, Sanada-san was very different. He was a very sort of effortlessly commanding without being overbearing in any way. And I guess he instilled an example of just kind of, he cared so much about making this project and all the different facets of the project, and he would really concern himself with maximizing
everything, and you know, could only so much pride in it, and love for what we were making, that it was just sort of something that just kind of rubbed off on everybody, because you really wanted to do good work because of the example he was setting, and aside from just being a much more experienced actor and somebody who's been in this industry for such a long period of time, and as a younger actor, it's something you see and you're like, it's always great to learn from these people. But he did have an incredible command of everything, but it was just his sort of presence alone. It wasn't overbearing. It was just sort of this like loving, nurturing environment where everybody was encouraged to really just do their best and make the best work they could.
Which is obviously an ideal environment to kind of work in, you know? And you've got a huge ensemble cast here. And what I like about this story an awful lot is that when he comes in, sort of the Anjin isn't, you know, he's not a white savior character. If anything, he's like the opposite, because he's far from useless, but in many ways, he's kind of an observer, right? Like he's not like he came in and he revolutionized the way they all fought, despite bringing his cannons with him. You know, I like that it's very much a Japanese story, and he's an observer, and like he's kind of sucked into that culture. I mean, did that sort of surprise you about this story? I felt this series had much more of a Japanese feel to it.
Yeah, like the book changes its perspective frequently across so many different characters, sometimes even within the confines of a single chapter. So the other characters have always been the substance of the book overall. And Blackthorn's just what has always been, just one component of that. Maybe he's the first, you know, maybe he's the introductory viewpoint, but the purpose of the book is that it develops and evolves beyond just his viewpoint, and he finds a context within something much bigger than himself that's already going on when he arrives. So I think that what I guess this show does is maximize the viewpoints that were in the book, and also sort of authenticates them in a Japanese way, because in the book there was not this level of Japanese. Obviously, these characters in our adaptation are speaking properly, and he's there, and he does have a purpose, but he's really a component, not a component without an arc entirely, but it's really about how all of the different characters and in the show and the book amount to a sort of a great happening. And it's about how, you know, all of their actions and relationships amount to something new and pivotal for Japan.
But going back to your character, obviously he's based on a real guy, isn't he? William Adams was the historical figure. Like, what did you find out about him?
Well, that he existed was, I suppose, the first thing. Because I remember going a couple of weeks without making the connection between William Adams and John Blackthorne, and then I looked into William Adams and what he went on to achieve after the time constraints of our story have ended, at a time where Japan was closed off, and he did do some pretty astounding stuff, particularly for an Englishman in Japan at that period. In that period, he negotiated unique trading rights for two Dutch ships to come to Japan a year, which at the time was not a privilege that the Portuguese Catholics had been afforded. So he did some pretty astounding stuff. And it must have taken a fairly unique character to have forged relationships in that way. So, but I couldn't take him too literally, because I was before we started, I was very much aware that this is as well as being sort of hopelessly intertwined with what hopefully would be a fairly authentic historical experience, it was also a piece of entertainment that demanded a character, and the character had a purpose to fill within on a scene by scene, episode by episode, and across the story basis. And so it was a case of sort of treading a line between not allowing the research to interfere with the dramatic requirements of the script, I guess. Yeah.
Cosmo, thanks very much for your time. It's much appreciated.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to me, and have a safe onward journey.
Okay, that was Cosmo Jarvis, who stars, of course, as John Blackthorne in Shogun. And now let's talk about Shogun, shall we, guys? And, of course, this is based on an epic novel by James Clavell, like a doorstop size book.
I can confirm, because I didn't know the series was coming last summer. I should have, but I didn't. And I chose this book randomly to take on holiday with me. Went to Croatia. Mm-hmm. I rather rashly packed this book and two others.
two thinking, items of clothing.
Oh, yeah. It's well over 1,000 pages. And spoiler, I did not finish it. I was still reading it in November. But it's a huge, huge story.
Yeah, this is a legendary book, isn't it? And it's been adapted before, we should say. In 1980, it was adapted for American TV as an epic. I mean, is an epic, epic series. That was also pretty epic for the time.
But also following on from Roots, I think it was one of the very first instances of proper event TV. I think a third of all American households watched Shogun when it aired in the 80s. So it was a massive deal.
It was the rise of the introduction of sushi restaurants to America is attributed to Shogun, the TV series.
Wow, really?
And apparently it was so huge and so influential that it transformed American culture in a way. And like James said, a third of the country were watching it. Yeah. It's absolutely crazy.
I can't recommend that original series because it takes a really odd perspective. So unlike the book, it's very much from Blackthorne's perspective. You're in his head. So much so that the Japanese in the original series isn't really subtitled. Instead, you get, and this is absolutely true, Orson Welles does a kind of a narration. He sums up what is being said. Well, Toranaga has just said that, it's like a really odd device. What I love about this show is it immerses you in the Japanese culture to the extent where a lot of it is subtitled. About 90%, I would say, this is in Japanese subtitle, but it feels so organic and it feels very welcoming. And I feel like this, instead of giving you that outsider's perspective from Blackthorne's point of view, it gives you a very Japanese perspective. Like you feel immersed in that culture, you feel part of it. And as Blackthorne himself becomes more acclimatized to Japanese culture, I think we do as well. And it just feels really, really organic. I thought that was amazing. Like, did you guys...
Yeah.
Like, did you get sort of drawn in by that?
No, totally. And it really, and much more so than the book as well, the original novel. This really steeps you in that culture. It brings you into scenes. And certainly Blackthorne is a major character, but it's not entirely told through his eyes. And I think that's a great improvement. I think it opens up that world and draws you in. And it's really interesting, different perspectives.
Yeah, there's a great moment in episode two. We shall say that, we've all seen differing amounts of the show. So I have chosen just to watch the first two for this. First two are going to be hitting Disney Plus just after this podcast drops. So that I stopped there and I want to be watching it on a weekly basis from now on. James, you bulldozed ahead, as is your nature.
Yes.
And Nick, you've watched about five or six.
Five, yeah.
You watched five or so. So I'm only up to episode two, so no spoilers, please. I haven't read the book, so no spoilers for what happens after this. But there's a really, really great scene between Hiroyuki Sanada, who plays Toranaga, and Cosmo Jarvis, who plays Blackthorne. And they both have translators, but gradually the translators fade into the background, and then you just cut to Cosmo Jarvis and Hiroyuki Sanada looking straight at the camera and talking to each other directly. I thought it was a really beautiful device. We've seen lots of things like that over the years. There's that lovely moment in Hunt for Red October where the camera pushes in slowly on their lips and then where they're speaking Russian and then it changes almost imperceptibly to English mid-sentence. And there's another one like that in Valkyrie where Tom Cruise is in reading out a letter in German and then it just changes to English. It's stuff like that I think is really, really great at getting you into this world and becoming acclimatized to this world, because this is a world that is completely and utterly alien and hostile to Blackthorne. What's great about this show and the way that they present it and the way that they take the time, Marks and Kondo, they take the time to establish all the different factions who are warring, but all the different characters as well. We get to see all their points of view.
Do you know what? And this genuinely, I believe these are the best subtitles I've ever seen. Because, and I couldn't work out why. Like when I watched this, came up in the interview with the showrunners. But when I watched this, because I historically always have difficulty with subtitles because they pull me out of things. And I didn't with this, and I couldn't work out why. And I don't know why I didn't twig. And I realized this, I guess, subconsciously, but they're really high in the frame. Did you notice that the subtitles are really high? They're near the middle of the frame, and they're very clearly blocked with a black background, so they're very, very readable. And they were very, very specific about when those subtitles should appear. Like, it should appear when he finishes this syllable or when the camera pans to this cut. Like, they weren't just put on. They were directed very, very carefully at the storyteller's intent to do what you need them to do. And as a result, they feel so organic. So you almost feel like you're just understanding the Japanese because you don't need to move your eye line down. You don't need to separate yourself from the action to read the subtitles. I thought that was a genius move.
It's really skillfully done. I mean, and it's bold as well. I think there's a confidence to committing to, as you said, like 90% of it, maybe even more, being in Japanese with subtitles in a big, expensive, prestige show like that. And I think it really pays off, like draws you in. No Orson Welles required.
No, exactly that. And actually, because like, if you're not a subtitle person, you should not be put off by this.
The 1-inch barrier.
That's right. That's right.
As Bong Joon-ho famously called it. But this time they put it in the middle of the screen. So, and it was a different font. And I don't know if this came up in your interview or not, James, but apparently it's the same font as is used in Greedo's.
It's Star Wars, yeah. They were very heavily inspired. They thought Star Wars did, Justin Marks in particular, thought Star Wars did subtitles extremely well. And so that was the main inspiration. So yeah, they picked that font for that reason.
And we'll get a Greedo cameo later on.
McClanky. Who knows? Greedo shoots first. But it is. I mean, it reinforces the idea that, you know, they're leaning into sci-fi and this feels a bit like a sci-fi. Yes, it's a historical epic, a period epic, but this is a world we haven't really seen before.
100%. So this is something I brought up in the interview as well. It's like I approached this, or I think one of the reasons I was drawn into this so much was that there was like a paper-thin separation for me between this and something like Game of Thrones. Like this felt like a fantasy as much as that does because, you know, while it's historical, It's based on real people. You know, loosely in some cases.
We should say it's set in the year 1600.
Yeah,
At least that's when it starts. And William Adams is the name of the real life navigator. Mm. You know, whatever mercenary, whatever you want to call him, who landed in Japan. And I was going to say what happens to him, but I don't want to give anything away. But suffice to say, he's kind of slowly accepted into Japanese society and finds himself taking on a whole new role. But yeah, it really weaves real history together, but makes, as he said, makes it feel like, and lots of people have compared it to Game of Thrones because it brings, it's so fascinating. The rules and the kind of the codes of this particular society are so specific and kind of so unlike modern day, you know, certainly anything we've experienced.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating kind of, and they do a brilliant job world building and setting up that across, and you're still learning things in later episodes that will pay off.
Yeah, and you're right, it's gradual. Like you're gradually introduced to more of this culture. And I like that it starts out, there's a seppuku scene very early on, which is deliberately pitched to be very jarring and alien and upsetting and make you realize how far removed this is from like everything we understand as society. But then gradually you start to understand the society, you understand the nuances of it, the characters let you in, and you start to really feel a part of it. And it, by the time you get to like episode 5, episode 6, it feels perfectly natural. I'm not sure if that's a good thing, but it really does. And I thought that was very, very deftly done.
Yeah. And what kind of the things that kind of like may look uncivilized at first, you realize that this is a very, very civilized, you know, and then in contrast to the England of 1600, where he comes from, which is just, you know, London is just a big pit of mud and you know, a bog. And it just, they do a great job of it.
Yeah. The scale of the thing is kind of mind-boggling. There's a wonderful stormy sea sequence towards the end of the first episode, which is really, really well done. And there's a lovely reveal of what the city of Osaka looks like also. So there's a lot of bang for your buck here. But it is, for me, it was about the small details of the world building, the majesty of the rooms, the majesty of and the costume design. And I know that Hiroyuki Sanada, who was also one of the producers, was very, very dedicated to making sure that all those elements were right, the costumes were right and whatnot. And Marks and Kondo were very, very attuned to making sure that they got everything right as well. And the dialogue also, where they wrote their scripts and then they would translate them into Japanese. Mm. And then they would send it to a Japanese co-producer or someone, a supervising producer who would essentially a historian who would double check it and make sure that it chimed with the way that feudal warlords worked and the way that Japanese society worked in that day and age. And then they would translate it back into English, and they would do that for every character. They would make sure that everything, every I, every T, everything was ticked off. The approach, the meticulousness is incredible, especially given that Marx and Kondo were slightly reluctant, I think, initially to get involved in this, and then they were drawn in by the complexity, I think, of Clavel's world. There's stuff in this that is mind-blowing. I can't wait to finish the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a very adult story. Like it's quite a surprising one because it's very talky in the best way, but it's about character, and that's what I think this focuses very much on. Like it's really understanding the nuances of these characters. And Anna Sawai, who plays Mariko, I think her character is absolutely enthralling, just really fascinating. You gradually start to understand what her background is and how integral she is to the overall storyline. But her dynamic with Torunaga and how she approaches both Blackthorn and, you know, the political stuff, because it's a very political show, that the, you know, we should mention it's that the recent leader has died, his heir is not yet of age, and there's a council of five regents, of which Torunaga is one, and these five regents are all scheming to kind of essentially overthrow the others, essentially wanting to be pronounced shogun, which is like an absolute ruler. So it is very, very, you know, it's four-dimensional political chess.
And Blackthorn's important to that because of his ship and the guns that come with that ship.
Yeah.
And otherwise, you know, it's not a question where they just would kill him immediately. He has a purpose and a use.
It becomes, there's a kind of a broader battle. So between the people on the council are kind of scheming against each other. But then there's the religious element as well. Mm. And Blackthorn is a Protestant, and, you know, he's up against the Spanish and the Portuguese and
who
the
Catholics,
and the Catholic Church, and the two different churches have got their own kind of agendas. So there's a lot of different agendas at play, and I think it is a complicated story. And I think I was wondering if they were going to simplify it a lot, because the book is very knotty in places and it's a lot going on. It's very dense, but actually they've kept almost everything, but they've just really boiled it down so it's easy to understand.
It's so big, you can see why it works. You know, the 1980 show was huge as well. I think the episodes were about 2 hours long. And this as well, 10 episodes, about an hour long for each one. The first episode is a little longer. You can see why you need 10 hours to do this. This could not be done as one movie.
No, it could. I mean, it's actually quite brisk considering how much they got to get through. They do a great job of adapting it. The opening of the book is a lot more on the ship, and there's a big build up to him arriving, but they get through it very fast. Very like grabby first episode.
Should we talk about some of the cast?
Certainly.
So Hiroyuki Sanada,
legend.
Seen most recently producer. In John Wick Chapter 4.
Yes,
that's right. Yeah.
Yes,
he's
indeed.
Fantastic in that. In the Japan part of that story.
Yep, and he's been in things like The Last Samurai and Avengers Endgame, where
West
he shows
World.
Up for a few seconds as well in that. And generally speaking, you know, I read an interview with him where he said that after The Last Samurai, he moved to LA and wanted to, you know, explore new opportunities. And those opportunities, I think, by and large, you know, he's been used sparingly in some of those movies that we talked about. And, you know, he's great in John Wick Chapter 4, but he exits stage left pretty early in proceedings. But in this is the first, I think, real slice of Western entertainment, I think, to really properly use him. He has a dignity and a natural grace and authority, which I think works really, really well for Torunaga.
It's a hard role as well. I mean, not least because he's following up, you know, the great Toshirô Mifune,
who was
in the 80s version of this. So,
yeah.
But it's a hard role because Torunaga is... keeps himself very much to himself, and that's even like something they discuss in the story of he has his own schemes and plots, but he doesn't share them with anyone.
He's opaque.
Very still. Yeah, opaque is a good word for it. And so that's a really hard thing to convey on screen because he's very still. He doesn't say much. Great Falcon. but yeah, he really is gripping. Like whenever he's in a scene, you're kind of your eyes are drawn to him, and he really has a presence. And yeah, it's interesting that he was in The Last Samurai because not miles apart in terms of the story, but just the way that the story is presented, this is much more a showcase.
I think the main difference here is The Last Samurai does still have, you know, wisps of that white savior idea, doesn't it? That Tom Cruise's character comes in and becomes a super samurai. I love the fact that Blackthorn is screamingly inept. Like, you know, he brings nothing to this party whatsoever. And I think that's really good that he's an observer and he's gradually subsumed by this wider culture, but he doesn't come in to save the day. He doesn't, I mean, yes, he has a ship that has cannons and that is useful to them. But I like the fact that he's still this sort of lumbering oaf, you know, with a heart of gold, certainly. And he's brave. That's absolutely true.
But smart enough to, at one crucial point, play an even more of a big oaf,
right,
you know, than he is.
Yes.
So he has got some nous.
He does, yeah.
And he's got his wiles. But yeah, he's certainly not the swaggering hero who comes in and, yeah, and shows everyone how it's done.
You get the impression that Toranaga like tolerates him like you would like a pet monkey. You know, like he's yeah. like, he doesn't think, wow, this guy's good. He's like, yeah, this guy's quite entertaining.
Might come in useful.
Yeah. But Toranaga's great. He has an imperial kind of grace to him. Like he does, he has this sort of aura in all the scenes that he's in that you can totally imagine just being just, you'd feel deferential to him, I think, if you met him.
And then we have Tadanobu Asano, who I think most people listening to this will know as Hogan, one of the Warriors Three, the ill-fated Warriors Three in the Thor movies. But he's great in this, isn't he? As well as Yabushige.
Yeah, Lord Raiden from Mortal Kombat as well.
Indeed.
But yes, Yabushige's great. I love this character because on the one hand, he is part of this wider culture, but he's the one who almost feels the most divorced from this kind of Bushido code where, yeah, honor's great, but he is 100% in it for himself. You know, and he's a bit wily, he's a bit duplicitous.
He's a bit woo, bit wee.
A bit woo, bit wee. Yeah, he is absolutely.
He's a wheeler dealer.
He's properly shifty. But he, like, crucially, like, he comes across as a real sadist very early on because remember he boils one of the sailors alive. And that is the one scene that I very vividly remember from the original Shogun because it was really upsetting. And, like, it's interesting there. But actually, you learn that, again, he's not a black and white sort of villainous character. He is very amoral. He's very complex. And I think he feels hamstrung by this code, this honor, by being tied to his liege lord more than anyone. So he's always trying to kind of slip through the cracks. He's trying to find ways out. He's trying to kind of play the game to find a way out of these binds that he gets himself in.
Yeah, he's fascinated, isn't he? As are we all, by the moment of death. Because that's the moment when, you know, you see how someone embraces death when they know that there's nothing that they can do to stop themselves from dying. He's fascinated by that. So he's slightly disappointed when the guy just kind of dies.
Screams and dies. Yeah.
Screams and dies. He wants something a little bit more profound.
Yeah, he's a really interesting character to watch because he's kind of, his dynamic is that he's caught between two sides and he's trying to play everyone off against each other. He's, you know, there are two big factions. There's Toranaga and Ishido on the other, these two big factions who are lethal enemies. And he is trying to play everyone off against each other. And it's really fun.
Yeah, he's great. He is so good. As indeed is Cosmo Jarvis, who has been up and coming, I think, for a while as an actor. He was in the likes of Persuasion. He was phenomenal. The first thing I ever saw him in was Calm with Horses, which is an Irish drama, which came out in 2019. Yeah, 2019. And I thought he was Irish. His accent in that is so good. His demeanor in that is so good. And so convincing. I thought he was Irish. When I found out he was English, it kind of threw me a little bit. Because he's great. He's got real young Tom Hardy energy here. So you can see Blackthorne at the moment, you know, when he first is introduced into the show, he does have smarts. Yes, he is a man of learning. But he's also someone who has a filthy tongue and a red-hot temper.
He's a man of passions, which kind of often sets him apart from the much more reserved Japanese culture. Like, they keep a lot of it on the inside, and he has no filter whatsoever.
He's got a lot of rough edges, and he's also playing the most British, the most English character of all time, because really his children's names are Tudor and Elizabeth. And so he's literally a Brit abroad. And that's kind of the fun of that arc, is seeing him go from this very traditional English guy to what he becomes.
Yeah, he's great. Anna Sawai as well, also very good.
Indeed, Anna Sawai, who people might know from stuff like Girihachi, Monarch, and indeed Fast Nine. But she plays that character really well. And there's a scene very, very early on in the first episode. You see her talk another character down from taking her own life. And that speech she gives about honor and duty and the kind of the call of death tells you a lot about that character. And, you know, it takes a while for us to find out what her background is, who her family is, and how she plays into Toranaga's plans. But, you know, it's easy to kind of think of her like that she's a love interest, but she's very, very far from that. Like, it's very much, I think it's a triple head of this story. There are many, many great characters in this, but I think Toranaga, Mariko, and Blackthorn tell the three central narratives to this.
It's a pretty dark backstory.
It is dark, very dark.
And she plays Haunted well, but there's flickers of it. It's not like she's, you know, but there's also a lot of lightness. Mm. There's a lot of different shades to it.
And she's, and crucially, she is a Christian convert. Like, she's a Catholic. Mm. And Blackthorn is a Protestant, and they don't get along.
Really?
Yes. With the politics of this, again, it's really interesting because you've got the warring politics of the Japanese factions, but then you've also got this Portuguese element, because obviously the characters speaking English in this aren't speaking English. They're all speaking Portuguese, but we just hear it as English. Because Portuguese and Japanese are the two languages that they use. But the fact that the Portuguese sort of culture has infiltrated and they've converted lots of the Japanese people to Christianity, to Catholicism in particular, including two of the five regions. Mm-hmm. And that plays a big part in the politics of the story.
So when we hear Blackthorn speak, is he speaking English?
He's speaking Portuguese.
He's speaking Portuguese.
Yeah, he's speaking English when he's speaking to his crewmates, but when he speaks to anyone else outside, it's Portuguese.
I believe his crewmates are Dutch.
Oh, so maybe he's speaking Dutch to them. Who knows?
Or double Dutch.
what it was to me.
Or double Portuguese.
But yeah, but you do get this amazing, one of the best characters in the story, Rodriguez.
Yes.
Played by Nesta Carbonell,
yes. AKA Batmanuel from The Tick.
Obviously, known from other things as well.
Yes. Richard Alpert from Lost.
Yes, from
Lost. No. He's Batmanuel from The Tick.
Sure.
He's also in one of the Dark Knight films. But
he's in two of the Dark Knight films. He is the mayor of Gotham.
That's it. Not that's Batman. It.
Yeah. This is Batmanuel aside, I think this is my favorite performance of his. It took me a while to realize it was him. And then when I did, it's such a great...
He's so good.
I mean, talking of creative swearing.
Salty swear words,
Blackthorn,
yes.
Sort of embark on a sort of swearing contest as the show goes on. There are some absolutely incredible insults, which we probably won't repeat here, but I'll be using them later. he's a salty sea dog, maybe even saltier than Blackthorn, and the two of them have this great dynamic and swear at each other.
Very salty at one point.
Yes.
When he gets plunged into the brine.
That's pretty salty.
Yeah, just in case.
Yeah.
The seawater is salty. I just wanted to make that clear for people.
Physics 101 by Chris
Hewitt. There you go. Should we talk about Japan?
Certainly.
Because obviously this isn't Japan as it is nowadays. And it was fascinating, you know, Rachel Kondo, who is Japanese-American, and Justin Marks, you know, they were a bit surprised by how much, I think they were hoping that they'd be able to connect the modern Japanese experience to the Japan of 1600. And they found that the two worlds were vastly different. Mm. But it is fascinating. But it's a show that just, I adore Japan. I haven't been back for a long, long time. I think whenever Nick and I went in 2008, that was the last time. But I've been a couple of times. It's one of the greatest places on earth. It's just extraordinary. And this just has lit a fire under my backside to not to travel back in time, because I would be dead within seconds, I think. But to try and go back to Japan again is just an extraordinary place, isn't it, Nick?
It is. We went to the Studio Ghibli Museum. We went to a ninja-themed restaurant.
We did.
Where our menus were delivered by ninjas or ninja out of a secret trapdoor, as I recall.
Yeah, yeah.
None of that, sadly, is in Shogun so far. But
no,
I'm sure,
not
I'm
yet.
Sure, I'm sure a ninja restaurant will turn up before
not
the
yet.
End. There are ninja in Shogun. I don't think that's a huge spoiler to say.
There's one behind you right now.
Oh.
He's gone. It's fine.
There he goes.
Shinobi.
But yeah, it's an amazing place, and like just a completely unique culture unlike anywhere else on Earth. And yeah, I just think it's kind of captured so well in this show.
Yeah, very much so. Jimbo, you ever been?
I've never. I really desperately, desperately want to go to Japan, yes. And this made me really want to go to Osaka.
Yes. Did we go to Osaka?
We did.
Or did we go to Kyoto?
Yeah, Kyoto.
Kyoto. Yeah, we went to Tokyo, and then we went to Kyoto. We went to Hiroshima.
Yes.
We went to
another restaurant where we sat on a boat inside a shopping center with a lagoon around it.
We did.
And we were given fishing rods
to catch
maggots,
yes,
with which to catch our dinner. And we failed to catch anything.
Yes.
So we went to another restaurant and bought some food.
True story. Yeah, there's lots of different themed restaurants in Tokyo, particularly. I'm sure there are in other cities as well, where, you know, there's a gimmick. So the very first time I ever went to Tokyo was in 2005. For a friend's wedding, a friend of mine who moved over there and lives there to this day with his wife and kids. And they took us to try and stave off jet lag because of the time difference, because it's brutal. Because you're 12 hours ahead, I think, or 11 or 12 hours ahead of the UK. So when you land in the middle of the morning, you're just absolutely all over the place. And you have to try and stay awake. You have to keep going till about 10 p.m. So he took us to this place where it was like a dungeon-themed restaurant. But what he didn't tell us was that halfway through the meal that they would simulate a monster attack on the place. And you were in your individual cells having food. And then a monster would just leap through the window and paw at you with monster hands and just attack you and grab you and then run away again. There were sirens. The place was pitched into darkness and it was absolutely terrifying.
That's a lot of experiences. Yeah,
a lot of experiences.
We went to a theme park on the 40th floor of a skyscraper.
We did, yeah.
Namjaland, and found a 6-foot-high ice cream cone.
We did
find
it.
Next to the Cat of Enlightenment.
So good. Yes, it was so expensive as well. We didn't buy it. We were just lowly film journalists. But it's just an extraordinary place.
Great people. Beautiful. If you're going to go, try and go in April, because that's cherry blossom season.
Cherry blossoms.
And that's the most beautiful time.
I want to go back. Jimbo, let's go.
Okay. Now.
Let's do it right now. Let's pitch up.
To Heathrow.
To Heathrow immediately. Let's do it. Let's go.
You can almost get through the book Shogun on the plane if you start reading at takeoff.
Hey, you can watch the entirety of Shogun.
Yeah.
If you had all 10 episodes. Which people don't at the moment that they're listening to this. But they will. So come back at the end and tell us how it worked out.
But also, it finishes in April. So you could wait until the entire series drops.
Oh, my word.
Cherry Blossom.
Load it all up onto your Disney Plus app and then head off to
Cherry Blossom.
Cherry Blossom season.
Yeah.
While watching the entire show on the way there. There we go. We've planned all your holidays for you.
There we go.
Let's do it.
We should open a travel agency.
Should we do a little spin-off, Shogun Tours, and we can do this. And we just basically just charter a plane so you can fly to Tokyo.
And we take people in completely the wrong direction until someone has to run after us. And
yes, we will get lost terribly. Yeah. I think this is a great idea. All right. So before we go, what else can people expect then from Shogun, folks?
Battles.
Yes.
There are battles.
Yeah. It's a very talky show and it's, it's actually quite a still quiet show a lot of the time, but there are also some banging action scenes. And episode 3, I won't give too much away except to say the kind of, that one lets rip with the action and it's kind of multiple stages of the action. There's a really great boat driven scene, which is phenomenal.
The boat sequence to which you refer is a lot of fun. It's really well done. And I think Rodriguez and the Anjin Blackthorn come into their own in that.
Yeah. And you've got archers with flaming arrows. You've got ninja assassins. So you've got all that stuff as well as the power gaming. If that is power gaming a thing, power games is a thing.
Why not?
So I've invented power gaming. You're welcome.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, on the creation of both a new company for ourselves and a new game for Nick, that's it for this very, very special preview of a Shogun in association with Disney Plus, this co-pro, if you will, Jimbo, with the Pilot TV podcast. Very, very exciting. If we haven't convinced you to do so already, and hopefully we have, make sure you do check out Shogun, FX's brand new series, which you can do exclusively on Disney Plus. And of course, 18 plus, subscription required, T's and C's apply. But anyway, that is it. That is definitely it. All that remains now is for me to say goodbye to my two colleagues of such lethal cunning, Nick Desemlian.
Goodbye, Chris.
Goodbye, Nick. Goodbye. It's goodbye from James Dyer.
Sayonara, Chris.
Sayonara, James. And it is goodbye from me. I'm off to my nearest travel agents. As Puffy Amy Yumi once sang, Tokyo, I'm on my way. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Pilot out.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.